Thank you for your attention. We have this morning, right before lunch, which is a good time slot, a lecture on deflation, which is a very important subject. I'll start off, as usual, with a few definitions and then present our little program for the hour that is ahead of us. Deflation has been is today currently commonly defined as a sustainable increase of the price level, which is also called price deflation. There are two words that are important in this definition. The one word is level, right? So it's important that more or less all prices increase, not just certain prices, and that this increase be sustained. That is, it's not just a temporary fluctuation, but it's more or less permanent. According to an older definition that has been dominant in the 19th century and to some extent also until World War II, deflation has been differently defined as an artificial increase of the money supply. As a decrease of the money supply that previously had been artificially increased. So I was confused about inflation, deflation, right? So deflation, a sustainable decrease of the price level, and the traditional definition was a reduction of a money supply that previously had been artificially increased. The question here then is, what is to be understood by the word artificial? The explanation is, well, so usually this artificial increase has resulted from government interventionism. We encounter here the historical root of the word deflation, which comes from the Latin deflare, the opposite of inflare. So to inflare means to blow up, and so deflare, so then to deflate. So deflation in that sense then brings the money supply back to its normal level, and that normal level is then not necessarily the previous level, and because the normal money supply could have increased the meanwhile, and so due to some impact, typically government intervention, the money supply has been artificially increased, that is, increased beyond the level that it would have attained on the free market. So what deflation then does is to bring the money supply back to its natural level, which is not necessarily the previous level. And so without the inflationary impact, the money supply would have grown, let's say, from 1,000 to 1,200. Due to monetary interventionism, the money supply has been increased from 1,000 to 1,600. So therefore, then we have an inflationary impact. The money supply is 1,600, whereas under normal conditions, it would have been 1,200. What deflation then does is to reduce the money supply back to its normal level, that is from 1,600 to 1,200. And so this normal level is not the previous level. Okay. Now, as far as vocabulary is concerned, terminology is concerned, there's no reason to prefer one definition over the other, right? So in science, and by the way, also in human life in general, it's the most important thing is to be clear about how one uses the words, not necessarily to be obstinate in using the word in one sense or another. Many fruitless debates have been led under the participation of Austrian economists, but also of others, by insisting that this or that word only be used in this and that context. Well, I mean, there are more or less good reasons to insist on a traditional terminology, but of course, from a scientific point of view, this is a completely secondary question. I think the most important thing is always to have a grasp of the phenomena of the things themselves, right? And in order to analyze the things themselves, we just need to agree on how we use words. It doesn't make sense that person A uses the word deflation in the first sense and person B uses the word deflation in the second sense, because then, of course, we are talking past one another and do not come to understand our objections and our statements. So what I will do is, by and large, to use deflation in the traditional sense. Though what we will do in this lecture is to analyze the impact of price deflation. I'll try to be careful in stating explicitly that what we are talking about is price deflation. If I do not, then you should raise your hands and then remind me, call me back to order. So this is our plan. Oh, no, there's another thing, another preliminary. Deflation is, of course, a very contentious topic, and one of the reasons why we have a lecture on deflation at Mises University is because Austrian economists, in particular in the tradition of Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, have a particular take on deflation. The Misesian tradition stands out in that Mises himself continues a tradition that emerged in the 19th century, namely the so-called currency school. And this is what what sets the Austrian school today, or Austrian monetary theorists, apart from mainstream monetary economists, is the fact that they keep this tradition of the currency school, and that the central contention of the currency school is that the money supply, by and large, is irrelevant from an overall point of view. That is, you cannot improve the working of the economy by increasing the money supply. You cannot improve the working of the economy by increasing the price level, by increasing aggregate spending. And this is, of course, at the heart of contemporary mainstream macroeconomics, right, which has been infused with ideas that we call Keynesianism, but which, in fact, are much older than that. Right? So they reach back to the modern times, so early modern times, 16th century, 17th century, 18th century, and probably beyond this. And I say probably, if I say probably, it's just because we don't have any written trace of this. Probably it's older than that. Right? And it, so this debate that we have today between the Austrians and the mainstream economists is just a continuation of an age-old debate that has probably been led since the dawn of times. And at times, so today the Keynesian, the evil guys, have the upper hand, right? But it has not always been so. So sometimes the good guys had the upper hand. That was most notably the case in the middle to late 19th century under the impact of Adam Smith's ideas and the ideas of the classical economists. Because Adam Smith was taking these ideas head on and was arguing that, in fact, all these monetary factors have nothing to do with the wealth of nations. It has nothing to do with wealth creation. And it follows therefore, of course, that from a classical economic perspective, that is the perspective of the currency school, the perspective of Austrian economics today, deflation, in particular price deflation, is not an obstacle to economic development and economic growth in particular. So deflation, and that is, of course, not accepted by various groups competing in the realm of economic ideas today with the Austrians, most notably in the case of the Keynesian economists, right, who oppose deflation in all of its forms, right, price deflation, deflation of the money supply, anything, it's just all bad. Similarly, the monetarists, central banks is the second point. Central banks, right, have the fight against deflation very high on the agenda, and is probably the number one topic, right? Deflation is not always an imminent threat to the economy, according to central banks, so sometimes there are other objectives that they become more important. But no objective is more important than to prevent that deflation ever happens. And the reason is central banks have swallowed root and branch the whole Keynesian story about the operation of the market economy. And within this Keynesian story, we have in particular the concept of the paradox of savings. So if we increase our savings and as a consequence, spending on final goods diminishes, then the profits of those firms producing the final goods diminish as well. And as a consequence, the firms themselves then can spend less money. And so when consumer spending diminishes, and then the firms producing consumer goods themselves can spend less money, so their suppliers will have lower revenue, et cetera, et cetera. So the initial reduction of consumer spending triggers through the rest of the economic system and entails a meltdown, right? So then all revenues decline because firm revenue declines, then household revenues must decline as well. So people start spending less. So you get another round, a reinforcing round of further deflation, because if household revenue diminishes, then households can spend even less money on consumer goods. So you get another round of reduction of revenues, et cetera, et cetera. The economy evaporates in a bottomless pit. We are all gone. Fortunately, we have the central banks who prevent this, and of course our heroic governments who are ready to spend money if we are reluctant to do this, and if firms are, because capitalists are very unreliable spenders, so you need to have the guys with the big spending guns in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, and they will do the spending for us if ever we are too feeble, timid, etc. And so central banks, of course, they are the guys who provide the guns, because they can, at least in a fiat money regime, create as much money as might be needed to keep the spending level on the level that is necessary, right, for the smooth operation of the economy, the defenders of the market economy. Monetary economists also oppose deflation in the sense of a reduction of the money supply. So even if through political intervention the money supply in the past has been artificially increased, and monetarists would argue, well, we should not decrease, we should not allow its reduction. Right? We should try to stabilize the money supply at that level. But on the other hand, orthodox monetary economists, and there are not many left today of this breed, they tolerate price deflation. So price deflation is okay, most notably in an economy with healthy growth. We will return to this topic later on. Among Austrian economists too, right, there is the so-called Wieserian branch of Austrian, of the Austrian school, which is today represented by Lawrence White and George Selgin, who oppose both deflation in the sense of reduction of the money supply, but so have the same, ultimately the same, or a similar position as the orthodox monetarist economists. And what Selgin and White advocate is a stabilization of aggregate spending, of aggregate demand. Right? And according to them, such a situation which aggregate demand by and large remains stable results in particular in a system of competing fractional reserve banks. Right? They tend to operate in such a way that the level of aggregate spending by and large remains stable across time. And so for them too, any deviation from competition would be harmful, not only because it involves a violation of property rights, but especially because it would usually entail a reduction of aggregate spending or an excessive increase of aggregate spending, which might entail a disruption of the economy. We shall argue, along with, in that respect, with Murray Rothbard and Hans Zennolz and today Joe Salerno and Hans Hermann Hoppe and others, who argue essentially the same position, that deflation is beneficial in virtually all cases. There are a few cases in which deflation is not beneficial, particularly if it results from government interventionism, but it fulfills a useful social function even in those cases where apparently it wreaks great havoc in the economy. So our program concerns essentially these two points. Right? There are many things more that could be said about deflation, but I've already spent 15 minutes just on a little introduction. And we'll zoom in and focus on two scenarios in which deflation would play or does play a big role. The first scenario is one of monetary reform. And Austrians advocate sound money. They advocate the use of natural money, so a return to maybe to a gold standard or competing monies, competing use of silver and gold coins and so on. So if ever we enact such a reform, the likely result would be very strong price deflation for reasons that I will spell out in a minute. And the second scenario concerns deflation in a growing economy. In particular, if we do have a sound monetary system rooted in commodity money, then the likely result of economic growth is price deflation, again, for reasons that I will explain in more detail later on. This is the book cover of a little booklet that you can acquire next door. I have also discussed deflation in various other articles and also in a chapter of my book, The Ethics of Money Production, in chapter 4. There is a larger section on deflation, which also contains some of the arguments that I will present today. But I will go, the lecture will go beyond what I set out both in this brochure and in the book. Okay, so let's turn to price deflation resulting from monetary reform. The scenario is a return to the gold standard. And one consequence of having sound money is that this money becomes more interesting for people as an instrument of investment, an instrument of keeping one's savings. And people are more likely to simply keep the gold coins that they earn as revenue, keep them at home, keep them in a bank, if they trust the bank, if it's not a fractional reserve bank, right? Or dug a hole in the garden or whatever, and just save in the form of cash, cash holding. To some extent, that exists already today, and I've explained yesterday that this is not a very smart investment strategy, and of course, most of you are familiar with this fact. Now, in a natural monetary system, it would be a rational investment strategy, right? It's maybe not the very best thing that you can do with your money, but it is a sound way of building up and accumulating savings, simply stockpiling gold coins or silver coins. You could do this. And this is what people have done traditionally in past centuries. It's the main form of savings. And I explained to you yesterday in my lecture on financial markets that, in fact, it is still a very important form of savings even today. So if people save, keep their savings in form of gold, well, this implies then that there be less money spent on the other goods. That is, there would be both less consumer expenditure and there would be less investment expenditure, less spending on consumer goods, less spending on factors of production. Okay? So the question is then, does this scenario present itself from an overall point of view? Is this harmful for the economy as a whole? And I'll propose to you to analyze this in two cases, that is, distinguish two cases. The first one would be the case of a pure equity economy. There's an economy in which there's virtually no debt. And the second case would be one in which we have a debt economy. And the point is to highlight the fact that deflation creates problems, at least for certain market participants, in a debt economy. Whereas it has virtually no impact, not even in the short run, in a pure equity economy. In both cases, we can, right, so in the pure equity economy, all firms are financed by equity capital, don't have any debt, households, don't have any debt either. Governments don't have any debt either. Ooh, this is a very heroic assumption, but or maybe there are no governments, right? So, right? So there's no debt. Right? Everybody's just using his own money, partnerships and so on, but there's no debt. And in the second case, we will assume that there's predominantly debt. It's very not much equity, it's a lot of debt. Okay. Now, in both cases, we can follow two sorts of hypotheses. The first one is the Humean hypothesis that any change in monetary conditions has a proportional impact on all prices. And so it's something that, that Hume proposed in his essays on money, published in the mid-18th century, and in which, in fact, he simplifies the analysis that had previously been proposed by Richard Cantillon, which is our second hypothesis, namely that the deflationary impact does not have a proportional impact and simultaneous impact on all prices, but has, so the deflation affects different prices differently. Some prices diminish by 1%, others by 11%, others maybe by 30%, and they don't diminish at the same time. Right? Some prices drop right away, others will drop later. So if we reason under the Humean hypothesis, what will be the impact? If all prices change simultaneously and to the same extent, well, it's clear then in this case, the deflation has no impact whatsoever on the operation of the economy. Let's say if my firm has a revenue of 12,000 units of money and my cost expenditure is 10,000, and now I'm hit by deflation, let's say the deflation cuts all prices in half, my revenue is 6,000, my cost is 5,000, I have exactly the same rate of return, right? My investment gives the same yield as before, namely 20%. There's no change. And with this lower monetary revenue, I can still buy exactly the same quantities as before. Maybe before, let's say, I've produced 100 microphones and I've sold them for 12,000. Now I produce 100 microphones as before, right, and I sell them for 6,000. It's the same physical quantity. Only the exchange occurs at a lower price level. And so in real terms, neither myself nor my customers are worse off. And my revenue as an entrepreneur, my profits, my monetary profits have diminished. But because all things that I buy, all the factors of production, but also all consumer goods that I buy as a household have diminished to the same extent, well, I'm exactly as well off as before. So deflation has no impact in that case. Things change a little bit if we consider the second hypothesis, the hypothesis of Cantillon. So here then, prices do not drop to the same extent and at the same point of time. So that means that for certain persons, the prices that they have to pay will drop stronger or earlier than the prices that they receive for their services or for their products. So these persons will gain. And there will also be other persons who experience that the prices they have to pay do not drop as fast or not as much as the prices that they obtain for their services. So they lose. Okay. So under this realistic scenario, then, a deflationary process entails winners and losers. And that's, of course, what we have always in the market economy. Any change entails winners and losers. And if people change their opinion, they no longer buy microphones from me, but from some other company, I lose, the other guy wins. My employees lose because I cannot pay them the same salaries as before. My suppliers lose because I cannot pay them the same prices as before. The other guy, the employees win, suppliers win, the wife wins, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So you always have winners and losers resulting from any change in the market economy. So again, right? Deflation in that respect does not present an extraordinary problem. Right? It creates the usual problem that entrepreneurs have to cope with in a market economy, namely change. And any change that occurs will have a differential impact on different people. It does not affect everybody to the same extent. Right? But that's a general problem of entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurs cannot speculate on the price level in general. Right? They need to speculate on the prices that will concern them. And they can do this in a deflationary process just as they can do it in an inflationary process, just as they can do it in a process in which the price level is stable. Okay? So even here, then, deflation does not present an aggregate problem. Right? It presents a problem for certain individuals. Does not necessarily entail, by the way, massive bankruptcies either. Right? a company, in some cases, the companies might no longer be viable because their revenue is now too low as compared to their costs. So in that case, they have to close down. But it's not necessarily the case that they first have to experience the deflationary process in order to close shop. Right? If the entrepreneurs anticipate this event, well, they will close right away. So again, right, deflation does not present in that realistic scenario any particular problem for entrepreneurship. It's just one change in the economy as many other changes as well. Let's turn then to the second case of a debt economy. And here, indeed, we confront a particular problem. So again, suppose I run my company, I have revenue of 12,000 and cost expenditure of 10. But all my expenditure, or most of my expenditure, is financed by debt. It's not my money that I invest, but other people's money. So I've taken out money from the bank, and I've promised to the bank, okay, so you lent me 10,000. I'm the entrepreneur, so I invest this, and I pay you whatever, 1,500 or maybe even 2,000 interest. Okay, so this is workable. I can do this. Right? Now comes the deflation. My revenue falls to 6, and my cost, let's say, is still 5. Then, of course, I have a problem. Because I've taken out debt at a higher price level in the past. At the higher price level, I could serve my debt. But at the lower price level now, it's no longer possible. My relative revenue, my return on investment is the same as before. And it's 20%. I earn 1,000 euros now, or 1,000 units of money on an investment of 5. And before, I earned 12,000 on 10. So it's 20% in both cases. But the absolute amount of money that I earn is less. And I'm contractually engaged in restituting an absolute amount of money. Otherwise, it wouldn't be debt. It would be some profit sharing. So that's the problem that we confront in a deflationary scenario. Deflation confronts people that are heavily indebted with a major problem. And many of those then are likely indeed to become insolvent, cannot repay all the debt that they have taken out. This concerns both firms and households. Firms can take out too much debt. Governments, of course, as we know, they don't need to wait for deflation. And households, same thing, right? You can finance your house today, right? You can 100% finance possible. It's no longer necessary in the U.S. and various other countries to bring in any equity. So you buy a house for $500,000 and you take a credit of $500,000 with a bank. Right. Now, we have a deflation. All prices, let's say, are cut in half. So your revenue is cut in half. All your other assets lose in value. It's just half. So you can no longer serve the debt, especially if you're a young household. Right? If you're very rich, right? You're 50, 60, 80 years old, then probably you will survive the deflation. Your young household, essentially your revenue is the essential wealth that you have. Well, then you will not be able to pay back that debt. And so here then we have this problem. Now we need to comment on this, and I will make two observations on this case. First of all, I mean, how is this problem solved in practice? There are only two solutions. Right? The first solution is a renegotiation of the debt. Debtor and creditor can get back together at the negotiation table and say, okay, well, look, I cannot pay back. It's impossible. I thought I would, but now we have this deflation. My revenue has sunk. I cannot pay back the money that you lent me. Okay. And then the creditor, you can shed some tears and shout at the guy and do whatever. But finally, right, he might still accept a renegotiation of the debt. He might still accept, okay, well, then you pay me half of what we initially agreed. Or we reduce the interest rate. And the creditor is most likely to do this if there are no other alternatives. And in the scenario that we are considering here, there's a deflation, that is a general decrease of the price level, he's very likely to accept such a renegotiation because there's nobody else who will have much higher revenues and could pay back that amount of money on that house. So this is indeed what very often happens in practice, right? People just renegotiate the debt. Debt renegotiation can also occur in political forms. It's also been very often the case in deflationary periods. So then often, very often joined with what has been called currency reform. I will not go into this detail now. The second major solution is bankruptcy. Okay. So the creditor is unwilling to renegotiate the debt. He insists on payment. Well, in that case, so he says, I cannot, so I go bankrupt. That is, I liquidate. The family sells the house and restitutes the proceeds to the creditor or hands over the house to the creditor. Here you have it. Sell it at the best price you can get. Right? The entrepreneur sells his firm or hands the firm over to his creditors, and they can then run the firm as they see fit or sell it. So these are the solutions. There are no other solutions. So clearly this is a very hard fate for the individuals concerned, and it's a major catastrophe if you have thousands and even millions of people who are concerned at the same time. And so we can understand why deflation would have a bad press, right? Why people might not love this prospect. But my second remark concerns another point of view, is the overall point of view, the aggregate point of view. The crucial fact here is that deflation reduces the monetary value of assets, but it does not per se destroy these assets themselves. It's not because I go bust that my house evaporates. It's not because the house is just worth half the money that it was worth before that the house no longer is there. A house is still there. People can live in there, can host the same family, maybe ourselves. It's not because I, as an entrepreneur, I'm bust, I'm bankrupt, that the firm is no longer there. Right? The building and the knowledge of my employees and the relations with my suppliers and so on, all of this exists. All the physical infrastructure still exists. So the crucial implication is then that from an aggregate point of view, deflation, while it hurts one part of the population, and it can even be a majority of the population, does not imply an impoverishment from an aggregate point of view. The problem that deflation in such a scenario in which it creates massive defaults, the problem that it creates is the reallocation of property. Who owns the real assets that exist? Who owns the houses? And it's easy. You might say, okay, well, it's the creditors. But sometimes the creditors themselves have debt. And so sometimes you have bought houses and then you've lent money to somebody else. This somebody else is not able to pay you back, but you yourself, you have taken this money out from somebody else, from an insurance company or from a bank, etc. And so then it gets complicated. And this process can take a while to sort out. Sometimes it can be, governments try to accelerate this by suitable legislation. That's what the Germans did in the early 1930s. And so it's this process, right, which creates a problem. And the problem is solved as soon as it is clear who owns what, right, and the economy can then reboot from there. So you might ask, so what's the point of going through this nightmare? Well, one great point about such a deflationary process, which entails massive defaults, massive bankruptcies, is that the debt disappears. If I go bankrupt, the debt disappears, no more debt. And I try to settle with what I own, but the debt is no longer, the debt is then settled through the liquidation. And my creditor doesn't see back the money that he's given to me, but all other claims then evaporate. So the great thing about such a process is also it's very hurtful, very harsh, very hard in the short run. But it has this huge advantage. It's two huge advantages. The first one is, well, it takes out the debt out of the economy, so the economy becomes less fragile. Equity financing plays a much bigger role than before, so debt plays a minor role. And the second great advantage, at least in my sense, is that this process hits all those most who have been the main responsible, the persons responsible for the excessive debt that previously existed in the economy. That is, those people who have taken out too much debt. They are harmed first. I mean, all others are harmed as well. But they certainly are harmed. And they lose their house, they lose their firms, et cetera, et cetera. And other people will take it over. And this is some sort of, it's not really retribution, but there's some sort of justice in this process. Now, this holds true under both hypotheses, the Humean hypothesis and the Cantillon hypothesis. The Cantillon hypothesis does introduce, again, only the small additional fact. Well, it's not a small addition, but the additional fact that even such a deflationary process would not hit all persons to the same extent. And so due to Cantillon effects, some persons who are very much in debt might not default, even while others default. Right? So it has a differential impact. Let me briefly consider a scenario highlighted by Irving Fisher in the early 1930s. Under the impact of the experience of the meltdown of the financial markets from 1921 to 1931, particularly the experience of 1931-1932, so Philip Fisher developed a theory of deflationary spirals. So he said, well, so if you have an economy that is very much in debt, an initial deflation resulting from whatever cause might entail a self-reinforcing process. How does this process work? Well, it works in the way that when banks default, then a part of the money supply evaporates. And if a bank, let's say, okay, don't name any names, bank these days, right? I need to be careful, Bank X goes bust, right? What does this mean? Well, nobody will any longer accept a check drawn on Bank X. Nobody will any longer accept a credit card issued by Bank X. So all the money that the customers of Bank X had on their accounts, on their demand deposits with Bank X, can no longer be used. Right? The demand for those things is zero. So that part of the money supply diminishes or evaporates. Right? It's no longer there. As a consequence, then you have an impact, a deflationary impact on the rest of the economy. Part of the money supply diminishes, or is no longer there, so the price level tends to diminish. As a consequence, then, revenues of other market participants who had nothing to do with Bank X will also diminish, and so they will have difficulties paying back the money that they owe to their banks. So if then other banks go bust, right, the same process happens again, but reinforced. Other banks go bust, the money supply shrinks again. So there's an even stronger deflationary impact, and so on and so on. Right, so this process can lead to the meltdown of the entire banking industry. Okay. Now, Fisher's analysis of this process is correct, therefore people still cite it today. But the interpretation given of this process is usually, it needs to be qualified. Right? Keynesians, of course, think, deflationary spiral, this is the worst thing that can happen under the sun. We definitely sink into the ground, right? The center of the earth, right? This is an implosion, and nothing will remain standing after this. And against this, we need to emphasize again, right, that this process is, of course, limited. It's not endless, right? There is a positive rock bottom of prices that will not be affected by this deflationary meltdown. And that rock bottom is defined by the so-called base money supply. Right? Banks go, commercial banks can go bankrupt because they have to repay the money that they have to redeem the money that they create. And if they're unable to redeem, well, they go bankrupt. But the base money producer or the base money itself cannot go bankrupt. This is most patently the case if we consider a gold standard, right? We have a gold standard, and so we have gold coins as the base money, right? The gold coins themselves cannot go bankrupt, so they do not disappear. And so you always have that minimum money supply that remains, even if you have a very a dramatic deflationary spiral. So there is always some minimum spending that catches up the economy, that provides a rock bottom to the rest of the economy. And even in a fiat money regime, right, the base money supply, the base money producer, namely the central bank, cannot go bankrupt. Right? You know, this here is technically, this is debt, is central bank debt. It's debt of the Federal Reserve System. Now, I encourage you, if you have the opportunity, don't spend much money on this. If you have the opportunity, go to a Federal Reserve office and you smash this on the table and say, pay me my debt. Pay me the money that you owe me. The poor guy at the counter will not understand your request, of course. Because this is an accounting, right? This is debt is an accounting fiction. And because this is not debt in real economic terms. Juridically, yes, that's debt. From an accounting point of view, yes, that's debt. But in real terms, you cannot. Right? He will, if he's a nice guy, he will give you $5 $1 bills or something, right? Just to to give you something to get this crazy guy out of the room. Right? It's not debt. So the Federal Reserve cannot go bankrupt. It's impossible. As long as they produce the very monetary objects that are needed to reimburse their debt. In terms of which the debt is defined, they cannot go bankrupt. So this implies that even in a fiat money regime, then the deflationary spiral does not lead to ground zero, but it has a stopping point that comes before. Of course, there's another stopping point that comes the form of all those companies and households that have virtually no debt. And let us not forget there are quite a few left standing of those, right? So all these people are, of course, not affected. And their spending is not negatively affected by the deflation. So second hypothesis, we can neglect this also. Now, so we could conclude already here, but I would like to walk you through some considerations pertaining to growth deflation, right? So we have seen that in this case, so there is the change of a purely monetary nature, right? The demand for money increases due to a monetary reform, and as a consequence, we get a deflationary process. And the deflationary process is certainly difficult for certain parts of the economy, certain parts of society, and most notably, the most powerful parts. Right? Who are the guys who are most indebted? Well, it's banks, right? And it's governments. So deflation in a debt economy creates a spontaneous alliance of very powerful people. That's the reason why deflation, that's the essential reason why deflation has a very bad press. What the Austrians do is the same thing as the currency school has done in the 19th century and that the classical economists have done before, is to stress, yeah, okay, that's very hard for them. But it's not an aggregate problem. Right? The problem that deflation raises is not an economic problem, it's not a macroeconomic problem, it is a political problem and a sociological problem. Deflation threatens the establishment, right? And the false elites, that is, those elites who have come to their position on a mountain of debt. Okay, let's briefly... Oh, yeah, price is sticky. 10 prices adjust, yeah, the answer is yes. Right? So certainly, theoretically, there's no problem. Empirically, prices adjust downward as well, even in our days with very strong labor unions and so on. 10 years ago, we had some good deflation in Germany, not 50%, but more like 1%, 2%, something like this. And of course, it hit certain firms more than others. And guess what happens? Well, everybody got together at the negotiation table, and they reworked the labor contracts and redefined them. So it's possible to do this, even in a country like Germany, with very strong labor unions. And it's a matter of the will, right? Prices are, of course, not perfectly flexible as in the perfect equilibrium model or something like this. Prices are as flexible as human beings let them be. And it's a matter of, price is a matter of the will. Right? And you can get a price as flexible as you wish. And under a great necessity, right, if there's as misery looms around the corner and so on, people tend to be very, very flexible. Okay, price deflation in a growing economy. Economic growth, and this is something that is unfortunately completely neglected in mainstream economic thinking, economic growth has a deflationary impact. And this is lesson number one. Growth entails deflation, not always in the absolute observable sense. Right? Of course, we have growth, and we had a lot of growth in the past 50 or 60 years in an inflationary environment, so prices were rising, the price level was rising at the same time. But growth always makes that the price level is lower than it would have been the case without the growth. Economic growth, creating more goods and services that are being sold on the market, and makes that more goods and services are now competing for the existing money supply, so this exercises a pressure on unit prices. So let's briefly highlight the consequences of higher aggregate savings. I will do this quite fast, because I want to get back to the paradox of savings. Right? I will do this quite fast because you've gone through most of the stuff already in the previous lectures on Austrian capital theory, at least I guess so. So what I will do now is to make one simplifying hypothesis, namely that monetary conditions are constant. Right, so there's no change in the money supply, there's no change in the demand for money. And the implication is that aggregate spending is always the same. And that hypothesis is useful to highlight the fact that, well, if we abstract from monetary conditions, right, economic growth always entails a tendency, a deflationary tendency. So if we save more under this hypothesis, then of course our consumer spending will diminish by definition, right, because we have revenue and we can either use it for consumer expenditure or for cash hoarding, right, or for investment expenditure, three possibilities and not more. And if we assume that the monetary side remains constant, so my demand for money remains constant, that is, I'm not hoarding more or less than before, then there are only two alternatives left, namely either consumer expenditure or investment expenditure. So if I'm saving more, well, that means that my consumer expenditure diminishes and my investment expenditure increases. So reduced consumer expenditure then necessarily entails lower revenues for the firms and the individuals working in the consumer goods sector. Okay. The price level will diminish, right? The consumer price index will diminish. And there will, as a consequence, be reduced investment in the lower stages of production, that is, in the consumer goods industries and the industries closest, so the suppliers, the immediate suppliers of the consumer goods industries, because their revenues diminish. Okay? So, the Keynesian story is correct as far as consumer goods industries is concerned, or are concerned. And the problem of the Keynesian interpretation of the economy is that it consists, in fact, in some sort of microeconomic reasoning that generalizes the situation that prevails in a particular sector of the economy. So the Keynesians do exactly what they always reproach to the imaginary classical economists. And the Keynesians say, you commit the fallacy of composition. Savings is good for one individual, yeah, but not for the economy as a whole. If one ghastly individual Scrooge McDuck, one of my heroes. Scrooge McDuck is saving, accumulating. He refuses to play, to live up to his civic duty of spending on consumers' goods and so on. And so he's enriching himself. But he's impoverishing the economy because revenues of companies drop, so companies can spend less, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So the Keynesian's always with the finger very high. You see?
You see?
What holds true for an individual does not hold true for the economy as a whole. One individual can enrich himself by saving more, but he thereby impoverishes society as a whole because he sets into motion a deflationary spiral that threatens to eliminate all the rest of the economy. But the Keynesians themselves, they commit that fallacy. They reason as though the whole economy was just one big consumer good industry. And that's not the case. The economy also consists in producer goods industries, capital goods industries. And it is not necessarily the case, and in fact, under the scenario that we have observed in the past and that Austrians envisioned in their analysis, it's exactly the opposite. It's not because spending on consumer goods diminishes that spending on all producer goods must diminish as well. It's precisely the opposite. Spending on consumer goods will increase, and producer goods will increase. There will be more investment in the higher stages of production. I will give you a numerical example in a minute. So there will be, as a consequence of the increased investment in the higher stages of production, there will be new branches and new firms that didn't previously exist. And so we get a higher sector payroll, right, in industries that are removed from consumption. As the sector payroll diminishes in the consumer goods industries and the industries of their suppliers. So that means then that labor and raw materials and also intermediate goods to some extent move from the lower stages to the higher stages. And more people get employed in industries removed from consumption and less people get employed in consumer goods industries. Now, this is not some weird economic theory. This is exactly what we observe in economic development. Just think of European countries at the beginning of the 19th century. Most of the labor was employed in agriculture, very close to consumption. You were buying very few, very primitive tools, and by and large, you produce directly consumer goods. Now comes the Industrial Revolution, so you have huge capital accumulation, huge accumulation of savings. So what happens? All these people, they move from the countryside to the cities, and they start working in factories. Yeah, that is, in industries that are more removed, often, not always, often more removed from final consumption than the farms on which they had worked previously. Now they're working for companies that are producing tools for agriculture, chemical industries, car industry, they're producing tractors and stuff like this, right? Equipment for agriculture. So the few people who are still working on the countryside in the fields, they're fewer in number, but they're more productive than before. Now they have tractors, they have fertilizers and all this stuff, which is produced in the other industries where the bulk of the population is now working. And so they're producing more agricultural products than before. That's economic development. That's economic growth. And it's exactly this process that is at work here in the context of the Austrian scenario. Now, if we have the hypothesis of constant monetary conditions, then, of course, what does this mean? So we get more output, physical output of consumer goods, but there's less spending on consumer goods. Right? So this means that there is all these goods are now being sold at lower unit prices. In other words, there is very strong price deflation. Okay. Let me give you an example. So we'll compare two structures of production. As is this structure of production, which reflects an economy relatively poor in capital. And what you see is here, so we have consumer expenditure of 550 units of money. And we have here firm A, which in fact represents an entire industry. It's a consumer goods industry. It's just one firm. As Austrians are not afraid of monopolies, free market monopolies. Right. So it's not real monopoly, right? It's just the single firm is most efficient in consumer goods industries. And firm A is buying three types of goods. They're buying original factors, so land and labor, so raw materials and labor, essentially. They're buying fixed capital goods, that is tools, machines, installations, and so on. And they're buying intermediate goods. Okay? Now, the overall expenditure aggregate demand in that economy consists in the total productive expenditure that's going on, right? And this is, if you add up all of these figures, it's 1,500 units of money, okay? Believe me, we don't do the math here, right? This is 1,500 units of money, okay? So aggregate demand is 1,500, aggregate revenue is 1,500, and out of aggregate revenue, people are spending 550 units of money on firm A, right? And the rest is invested. Invested by whom? Well, by firm A, by firm X, and by firm B. So the other 950 units of money are invested. Right? And we see each of the firms is operating profitably. Each of the firm, in fact, earns a revenue of 10%. Right? Firm A has a cost expenditure of 100 plus 330 plus 70, 500 units of money, and they earn 550, so they have 10% revenue, a yield. Firm B is the same thing, firm X the same thing. Now let's suppose, so there's no saving in this economy, and monetary conditions do not change, so there's still the same money supply, and there's still money hoarding going on, so people spend exactly the same amount of money as before, 1,500. Only now they will spend less on consumer goods, and they will try to invest more. How could this look like? So here's my proposition, how this could look like. You see, in this new economy, consumers are spending 420 units of money, so 130 less than before. And if the Keynesians were right, then the rest of the economy should not exist, right? It would just not be there, gone in a deflationary spiral, right? But what we see, in fact, is that all the other money has been invested in the economy. Right? So there's more investment less investment undertaken by firm A. Firm B has the same investment as before, but firm X has now largely increased its operation, and firm C did not exist before. So firm C is a new firm that didn't even exist before. Right? Whatever, if we think in terms of economic development, right, might be whatever, the IT sector didn't exist until the 1970s, 1980s. Entire new sector of the economy that emerges and becomes possible only because we have enough savings available to get them going. Okay. Now, again, each of these firms is operating profitably at a lower profit, right? It's a 5% profit rate, 5% yield, right? And the whole structure of production, the economy as a whole, is more productive, right? We have a stronger division of labor than before, and we have more roundabout production processes. So firm A, right, what is firm A doing? Well, they're churning out consumer goods, but many more consumer goods than before. Only they're producing them differently, right? There's much less labor in firm A, but they're using more tools, right, provided from firms working upstream and so on. Right? So they are selling a greater quantity of consumer goods against a lower payment. Great thing. Okay. So I think this kind of consideration, just give one example like this, and I hope you find it convincing that, the Keynesian scenario just evaporates, right? It's just wrong. There is no paradox of savings, right? It doesn't give a paradoxical result. Savings are rational from an individual point of view, and they're also rational from the point of view of the economic system as a whole. And we get, as a consequence, a deflationary growth process, right, which is certainly not less beneficial than a growth process taking place in an environment where prices rise. Right? And the great thing about a deflationary growth process is that the benefits of these price changes are spread out more or less evenly throughout the economy, whereas in an inflationary environment, there are always some guys who get the new money first, as we know. Right? So the benefits are not spread out evenly. Okay, very fast, the conclusions, right? Starting point is the economy can work well irrespective of the monetary conditions. Right? So that's the classical, that's the conclusion of the classical economists. That was the conclusion of the currency school. That's the conclusion at which arrived Mises also, in which the Austrian economists teaching here at this university, the summer university, hold as well. Right? It's not something that is original with us, and so we're not coming from out of the out of space, parachuting on the 21st century. It's a very long-standing position, right, on the working of the economy. So we don't have to worry about the price level. Right? The economy can work if the price level increases or if it decreases. Then it has nothing to do. It can work with a high level of aggregate spending, with a low level of aggregate spending, with a high money supply, with a low money supply. Doesn't impede the operation of the market economy. Right? Wealth creation is determined by factors that are completely different. Second, so price deflation, as we've seen from savings-based growth, is beneficial, and so is also a price deflation resulting from changes in the demand or supply of money, because this too, right, reflects the preferences of the market participants. If we have a monetary reform, reflects our preferences, we want to have better money, so we accept price deflation resulting from it. Deflation, as we have seen, poses short-run problems for indebted households and firms. Right? The problem consists, as we have seen, in transferring assets from insolvent debtors to solvent creditors and buyers of these assets once they get into the liquidation process. As soon as this problem is solved, well, the economy is operating as before. Even when deflation hits a debt-prone economy, it has very beneficial medium and long-run consequences. Right? As we've seen, the debt level is reduced. The fragility of the economy diminishes, right? Because debt is no longer there. Right? Companies can sustain bigger shocks than before. And so there is then a greater role for owner entrepreneurs, right? Equity finance plays a much bigger role. And the relative role of the financial sector, all financial intermediaries, etc., is diminished. So you get greater independence both in economic and in political terms. And finally, let's not forget, right, life goes on after deflation, even for those who have been hit by deflation. Right? This concerns government. Right? Let's not forget, governments go bankrupt also regularly from time to time. In the case of the U.S., it's been a while, but it has already happened. Right? There's nothing wrong if governments for a while will not be able to secure any new credits, because that's, of course, a consequence. Right? You default in your debt, well, nobody's willing to lend you for a while. Maybe not bad, right, as a cure, so like for a drunkard, right? Maybe go for 3 or 4 months without alcohol. It's maybe not bad. Corporate finance is based to a larger extent on equity, and households, indebted households, well, won't be anymore the owners of the places that they live in, but the renters. And that too, right, for a while, is certainly feasible until they have saved and accumulated enough capital so they can buy the house. And out of their own money rather than taking out a credit. Maybe not bad either. The rejection of deflation is essentially special interest planning. And we always, of course, all central banks and so on invoke always the interest of the nation as a whole and macroeconomic concerns, etc. But as I've argued, in line with this very long tradition, From an overall economic point of view, from a truly macroeconomic point of view, deflation is not a problem. It's something that solves problems, namely a debt problem, excessive debt problem. Right. So what we do in fighting against deflation is, in fact, to generalize the special situation of the very large debtors. And we take out, so their interest coincides with the interest of the nation as a whole. It's not true. Special interest. And, of course, these results should not be taken to imply that governments should hamper the natural production of money. Right? I don't say, well, we should create artificially deflation. I don't say we should make sure that the money supply never increases or something like this. Right? There is a natural production of money, which is good and fine. Money is being produced like any other good as well. Right? So these concerns here are not a case for deflation in the sense where we should
have the government intervene to bring about deflation, right? By any means, this would be the wrong conclusion to derive from it. But these considerations should free our minds, right, in confronting arguments from governments and other special interest groups that would like us to believe that the fight against deflation is in the interest of society and of the market economy as a whole. That is not the case. Thank you for your attention.